The next cases are 97402, 551, 2056, 2301. Libby Ross et al., David Davis versus Farmers Insurance.
Date of the accident.
This one?
Yeah.
I don't know how you get to look at anything else.
I don't know.
You should almost do that by entry, or two lines or three lines.
Because the day of the accident, all the coverage is applied.
Power here.
It's a matter of...
It's a contract.
Maybe it's just a matter of mathematics after that.
Yeah, please, the court. At this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. And I'll also be giving some of my time to Mr. Rosenberg, who will be arguing on behalf of the Ohio Academy of Trial Lawyers.
You need to watch your time.
Despite all the convoluted and complex legal arguments that have been made in the briefs and the Court of Appeals decision in this case, what this case really boils down to is a very simple mechanical issue of when and how a statutory amendment or a new lease to pass statute applies and is incorporated into an insurance contract. In this case, it's been stipulated that both accidents happened in 1993. The policies were entered into and expired in 1993. But the statute they want to apply didn't come into existence until October 20th, 1994. So we have an entire year gap between the two. So the Court of Appeals decision presents this court with the question, how does that statute in 1994 get into a contract that happened in 1993? Now, the foremost case that from this court on that subject has been briefed by both me and the OATL, Benson versus Rosler. And this court has long held that the law in effect at time of contracting defines the terms of the contract. Statutes that are in effect at the time of the contract become part of the contract. Conversely, if that statute is not in effect at the time of the contract or at the time of the renewal, that statute is not part of the contract. It does not define the terms and the conditions of that contract. And that's basically what this court said in Benson versus Rosler. Now, granted, Benson versus Rosler was a 4-3 decision, but what is very enlightening, I think, for the court in this case is the one issue that the court did agree completely on. Both the majority and the dissent agreed that there needed to be some sort of mechanism after that statute went into effect to incorporate those provisions into the contract. The majority said the previous provisions, in that case, anti-stacking provisions, were invalid and they were validated by renewal of that contract after the statute went into effect. The dissent said that since that language was invalid, it was void, and after a renewal, there had to be some negotiation to reinsert those provisions back into the contract. But both sides agreed that there needed to be something after the renewal of the contract, or after the renewal of the contract, incorporating that statute after it became effective. And that simply didn't happen in this case. And that's why it's really a very simple mechanical issue, because this court's already decided in Colby Holland that the statute cannot be applied retroactively, that being Senate Bill 20, pursuant to Revised Code 1.48. It's just not there in the language. So we have the statute being pushed back an entire year into a contract that never contemplated it. And therefore, we propose that the law that should be applied in this case is the statute that was in effect at the time of contracting, which was the pre-Senate Bill 20 version of 3937-18, which was, of course, interpreted in Cole and also in Savoy. It's important to point out we are not arguing that we are incorporating case law. We are incorporating the statute. The statute remains constant until it's amended, and that is what's adopted and incorporated into this contract. I would suggest that when you look at all the alternatives that have been proposed by the different parties in this case, the only logically consistent method, which will be best in the public's interest and which makes the most sense in such cases, is to apply to the statute in effect at the time of contract.
Let me give you two different scenarios.
I'm sorry?
Let me give you two different scenarios. Date of the contract, assume it's a 5-year insurance policy rather than 6 months like you get.
Right.
Date of the contract, 1992. Date of the accident, 1993. Date of the legislation, 1994. Contract effect, the legislation have any effect?
No, it wouldn't.
Okay. Date of the contract, well then you have to go through the Van Fossen test and all that. Date of the contract, 92. Date of the legislation, 93. Accident, 94.
The legislation still would have no effect because it wasn't part of the contract.
So,
you always have to go back to the contract.
So really you argue the date of the accident, your main argument is the day of the accident. What you really mean is the date of the contract.
Absolutely. If that is our first proposition of law, time of contract, our fallback position, our second proposal is the time of the accident, if the court is going to look at an accrual analysis as proposed by the court.
So under any circumstances, Senate Bill 20 is not to be retroactive in any of those circumstances.
That's correct.
That's a lovely contract entered into while a statute is in effect, subsequent to entering into it, the case against this court attacking that statute as being unconstitutional because a violation is the subject. Agrees with that argument because the statute is unconstitutional on that basis. The legislation comes back and enacts the specific statute, same language that was in play in that contract. With that just being a single piece of legislation, no single subject problem. So now, arguably a constitutional statute in effect. Now the contract, all the while the contract is running in effect. Two possibilities, the occurrence that happens during the hiatus while the statute is unconstitutional, and the occurrence that happens after reenactment of the exact same statute that was in effect when the contract was in effect.
And your question being, what would happen in those cases?
In both of those circumstances.
In the first circumstance where the statute was in question, or it was already declared unconstitutional.
Right, in the occurrence.
At that point, since it was unconstitutional, it's essentially like the rule of case law, where this Supreme Court overrules this prior case law. The statute didn't really legally exist, because it was unconstitutional. In that case, you'd probably be in a position more of interpreting the contract, and whatever other law may be incorporated into that contract would be more of a contractual interpretation. After that statute was reinstated, at that point, it would still not be part of the contract until there was a renewal after that statute went into effect. Until that time, the statute doesn't have any effect on that contract because it already existed before that statute. As I mentioned, my fallback position was cause of action accruing at the time of the accident. I want to just briefly touch on that. The case law, the Supreme Court here has always declared that an uninsured motorist case or claim accrues at the time that available policy limits are exceeded by the damages. Payment or exhaustion has always been inconsequential. And in fact, that's what you find in the statute's languages as well. It refers to both pre- and post-Senate Bill 20, as a matter of fact, it refers to available policy limits at the time of the accident. At the time of the accident is in both versions. Cole, the court said in the syllabus, it must be paid when the damages exceed both available policy limits. In fact, in the syllabus, it also referred to accidents governed by 3937-18. This court has consistently looked to the accident as being the time of the accrual.
You cited Cole when I asked you the other question, or just before I asked you the question. You cited Cole for the date of the contract. Cole really stands for the date of the accident, doesn't it?
Right. I was referring to the date of accident here. I said date of contract, I thought. Yeah, I'm talking about date of accident here now. Exhaustion, which which is the element that's been argued by the athletes in this case and adopted by the Court of Appeals as cause, an element of a cause of action, is nowhere to be found in any of the prior case law and neither in the statutes. All it is a procedural element in the contract relating to timing of payment. It is no more an element of the cause of action than the provision referring to arbitration. And in fact, the exhaustion requirement is not in the coverage section. It's not in the definition section. It's not even in the limits of coverage section. All it is in another section dealing with other insurance. And it's coupled with other things dealing with pro rata, division, excessive, it's another owned automobile. At this point, I'm going to sit down so I can give Mr. Rosenberg some time to address me as well.
Thank you, Mr. Maurer. Mr. Rosenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start under the theory that this whole concept of vested rights has been argued in a number of the briefs. It's really an irrelevant argument here. Because in order to even get to this concept of whether the rights are vested, you have to have a statute that applies to a pre-existing contract. And we clearly do not have that here. We have a contract that predates the statute. And if you cannot apply the statute retroactively to an existing contract, then you never even get to all these issues that have been discussed about preconditions, about whether you have to have an accident, whether you have to have an exhaustion, whether you have to have any contingency whatsoever. Now, let's take a couple of the scenarios that are given by the defense. Very interesting one, and that is...
Counsel, don't you have to have a tortfeasor the contract sits there and says, you know, you have underinsured should you need it, or uninsured. But isn't that key to have the accident? The argument about just it being date of contract, I'm thinking you've got to have a tortfeasor and limits of a tortfeasor to really assess whether you have any right to uninsured or underinsured coverage, right?
Well, Your Honor, there's a difference between the contract that exists and then your right to actually get benefits under that contract. In other words, your remedy under that contract. Let's say I sign up for an uninsured motorist policy right now.
But it's a contingency. It's a different sort of provision of a contract in that it is really a contingent right, isn't it?
Are you saying this is an executory contract, basically, until there's an accident? Is that basically your position, Your Honor?
That's true about all the coverage, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is you're buying a certain peace of mind when you buy an insurance policy. And what the defense is arguing here is you can actually have your accident. You can have your insurance policy. And you don't actually get any law that applies to you until you've exhausted your rights with the tort piece. And consider this scenario. You have an accident. You have a death situation. You don't know what law applies to your death plan. You've already bought an insurance policy until you exhaust the tort fees. The exhaustion of the tort fees may be a year or two or three after the date of the accident. Well, you bought an insurance policy, you bought all these rights, and all of a sudden somebody changes that on you, not only after the accident, but 3, 4, 5 years potentially after you bought the policy. What do you actually buy? None of us can actually insure ourselves and know what we're buying until every contingency in the world is exhausted. So let me give you another scenario. Let's say there was a contingency in the contract that said, we won't tell you what law applies to your case until the year 2050. Well, what you buy has been insured. You go out there and you buy a policy of insurance, and you have no idea what law is going to apply to you until the year 2050.
But under the peerless doctrine, I mean, that's true all the time. You know, if decisional law changes the interpretation of contract, for instance, I mean, that's the way it works. One's contract is interpreted by the law at the time it's presented for interpretation, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly our point. There's a difference between case law and statutes.
Mm-hmm.
Statutes are what are incorporated in the contract. Case law can change all the time, you're right. Once you've got an overruled case, it's like that case never existed to begin with. The thing that we're dealing with here is UM statute is what's incorporated in the contract. You only know what that statute means depending upon what the Supreme Court says and its verdict for interpretation.
But again, we always go back to this. That statute says thou shalt offer this coverage. It doesn't say thou will be insured,
does it? Well, that's an interesting point, because if we accept what the defense is saying here, that any time you raise your policy limits, you've got a new policy of insurance, want you to hold them to this, because if that's true, any change in the policy means you've got a new contract, whether you add a new vehicle, whether you add a new person, whether you change your limits. And if that's true, you've got to offer uninsured motorist coverage anytime there's a change in the policy. And we would love that for the claims department, because I think you would, have quite a few problems as the insurance industry, that there's changing policies all the time, every time you have a car. And if that's true, they've got to offer it every single time there's a change. I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for co-counsel's rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg. Mr. Freed.
Trying to distinguish Crayley, you'd do it on the basis that that was a statute of limitations case, would you not?
Your Honor, that certainly was one of the key issues in the case, but the court determined and ruled upon the statute of limitations issue in the context of when that claim would accrue. And only upon accrual, this court found, was it fair to start the limitation period running. So it was a key issue in that case as to when the accrual would occur. The accrual only occurred shortly before that limitation period was policy. As a result, this court was used to enforce it because it happened so quickly after.
And in Crayley, when we were talking about the statute of limitations, we said it was 2 years after the date of the accident.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that has undergone some...
So even if they have the date of the accident here, they'd be all right, wouldn't they?
Your Honor, given their interpretation of what the ruling wants to apply, actually what they're asking this court to do might well prescribe very small or short period of time for their cause of action than under the rule that the defense and the insurance company is actually proposing here, Your Honor. And that's why we think, and submit to the court, that the reasonable rule, the rule that should be applied in this court, is the one that the Court of Appeals in Montgomery County applied in this case, because it takes into account the facts as they unfold in this case, it takes into account the policy language of the Department's policy involved, and also takes into account both the case law and statutory law that affects and is significant to these different...
Of course, the other side of that is to go directly to our whole line of cases on contract that says that the law in effect, even when we did it with trusts and wills and pre-termitted heirs and others, we said the law in effect at the time of the document, that is the contract, was the law that had to be enforced. So you could say, if they really, if you go that far, you could say it's the time of the contract, not even the accident.
If you adopt that rule and find that the rights are fixed at the time of contract, what you do is come full circle, because the time of contract on both of these policies, and also at the time of the accident in both of these cases, the governing law, as announced by the Supreme Court, was Hill versus Allstate, Knox and Boyd. And if you embellish or impose upon these particular contracts and even these accidents, and they're suggesting the date of accident should be the accrual date, under both of these cases, Your Honor, the insured has no right to expect anything other than what he got here and she got here, because Hill versus Allstate, if we're looking to expectations of insured at the time of contracting, would be exactly what happened here. That is, you offset limits against limits. The insured is out nothing. The insured didn't pay any premium for anything he didn't get. And that's why, again, Your Honor, this all makes sense, because we're bringing the law up to date. We're bringing it up to date not only in accordance with the case law decided by this court, in accordance with the policy language of the statute, the policy language of the Department of Policy, as well as cases decided by this court. It makes eminently good sense for any number of reasons that the time of accrual of the cause of action by insured motorist should determine the governing law for that particular law.
You say that if they win on the contract issue, they lose on the Hill issue.
Correct, Your Honor.
But the next step is that when we overrule a particular case, it's though it never was.
Your Honor, but you can't have it both ways. If you're going to the date of contract and the rights are fixed at that time, then the rights are fixed. If you want to go with the date of accident, which is their fallback proposal, it's interesting that we actually have a distinction in views here. The Ohio Association of Trial Attorneys is at odds with the view of the plaintiffs in this case. They claim that the date of accident should not be one of the proper accrual dates. And it's interesting that plaintiffs are willing to adopt an accrual system, as we have suggested here. They simply want to take a different date of accrual. And when you compare using the date of accident as a accrual date versus the date of settlement for exhaustion of the tortfeasor as a accrual date, the latter certainly makes more sense under all circumstances.
Counsel, let's turn the fact pattern around a little bit. Let's say underinsured issue, instead of this employee case, the lawyers for Christine Savoy family went to lobby to legislature and said, look here, what happened to us? And this seems freshly on there to us. And they persuaded the legislature that definitionally uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage gets confusing to everybody. You think the case law statute, nobody can quite understand what it is. We ought to clear this out. Come up with another term that makes it clear that what you have here is coverage over and above to the extent that it's in the solar system.
So they put it in the
statute. So they brought in coverage. Would insurance be able to immediately use that statute, collect under that statute, apply that to existing insurance contracts, or would that a rule be that you have to wait until new contracts reacting to what the legislature has done in terms of broadening the benefit of the available dollars to insure until those new contracts do premiums is the one that would happen?
I'm not sure I can answer that question, but it seems to me that under either of those provisos situations, the rule we're suggesting would take care of itself. So if you are going to, that's right, you're going to know what the statute
like to know what the law is in the county contract, but as we all know, those things are subject to change. And that way too, given perhaps enough passage of time, insurance companies can also, the populace can also determine what they're trying to get from their insurance company and charge appropriate amounts of premiums and allow for certain amounts of recovery.
So the rule would work the same whether or not the legislature shrunk the exposure or expanded that initially the exposure under an existing policy?
I would think that expansion of the benefits would be a more favorable circumstance. Simply because you're not decreasing rights, you're increasing them. Arguments about vesting and arguments about constitutional impairment, obligation contracts, probably would not necessarily occur under that other circumstance where you're reducing rights or where you're expanding rights or benefits.
Well, I mean, it's to the detriment of the insurance company that has to pay those.
Potentially, that's correct. Your Honor, let me tell you, if I could, why this system that we propose is better, and why a single rule, as adopted by the Affirmative County Court of Appeals, is the rule that should apply here in these types of situations. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, it takes into account all the things that are relevant to the consideration here. It takes into consideration the policy language. Takes into consideration statutory law, takes into consideration the civil law that is in effect at the time that the claim is approved, the motorist claim is approved. It is certainly a very defining event. It is easy for everyone to simply apply a situation or a time limit to a particular event. That is some of the adoption for the 14th. It also allows the plaintiff or the insurer himself or herself to take whatever time is needed to sufficiently develop not only the claim with or against the tortfeasor, but also the claim with or against the uninsured motorist coverage should there be litigation or an issue or controversy over that. The concern is often how much damage is there? Is there liability? Is one operation enough? Is there going to be permanent injury? Is there going to be loss of work forever? All those considerations take time, and while all these things are being considered and being developed and damages are being calculated, the time is not running against the insured. The insured is given enough time to sufficiently develop all these items. You don't have to worry about is the time running. Is the 2 years from the day of the accident going to cut me off? Because the claim does not accrue until there is a settlement. So in that regard, the insured is benefited. By the same token, it's fair to the insurance company because the insurance company knows exactly what is going on. The court features. There's a trial. This court has already determined that the underinsured motorist carrier may well be bound, probably is bound by that determination of damages. Those things are all intertwined. So to divorce the court feature claim, the claim against the court feature, from the claim of the UIA coverage, does not make sense.
But you'd run into a problem then, the date of exhaustion, the statute of limitations having run already before the exhaustion takes place. That's what we got into with Bogan and Colvin, that whole line of cases.
That may be a problem. But what you do have to do, obviously, with the tortfeasor, you're limited by the existing statute. That is, you have 2 years to file against the tortfeasor, absent minority for some other disability. But during that entire 2 years, you aren't given that time to develop your claim against the tortfeasor. As we know, oftentimes, once the suit is filed, against the tortfeasor, that can be done very late in the case. It could be 2 years from the date of the accident. This will be timely. The trial date could be set within a year after that. On the eve of trial, because the case is not properly developed, the plaintiff dismisses voluntarily. He refiles. Another trial is set a year down the road. During all this time, he has perfected, at least reserves his rights against the tortfeasor. And all this time, he has not prejudiced at all his right to pursue the underinsured motorist carrier because That carrier cannot claim that cause of action approved or that claim approved until there is a settlement or exhaustion with the tort.
Why not? Because the policy provision always provides that you must bring your cause of action within 2 years from the date of the accident.
It's my understanding that rule is not being applied in that fashion. This court.
That's what the policy says, though, doesn't it?
The policy says that, Your Honor, but this court is not enforcing that type of policy where it operates prejudicially to the insured. In that situation, the insurer cannot be prejudiced, nor can the insurer, because the insurer can only be aware of what is transpiring. So it's a fair rule to both sides. It takes into account the facts and the practicality and reality of what happens in a UIN claim. That is the case sometimes. A two-year statute or a two-year time limitation will not be enforced by this court because the court views it as unfair to the certain circumstances. So, as the court in Cooter here in Franklin County determined, it's only upon exhaustion of the tortfeasor's limits that the two-year period starts to run. If it starts to run at all, there is a limitation period. Not all contracts do that.
Not to interrupt your argument, but we didn't say that 2 years was unreasonable. I think you're talking about the Colvin case. That was 6 months being unreasonable. 2 years was enforceable.
Correct, Your Honor. But I believe in the Cooter case, they were dealing with 2 years and determined that the 2 years began to run only from the time of exhaustion of the tortfeasor's limits, thereby giving the insured all the time he needed with the tortfeasor, subject to the two-year limitations, and then the time began to run on the UIN claim only then. Your Honor, if I may just briefly conclude, we are able at this point to add more sense, more clear rules about how to handle these UIN claims. We suggest that the approach offered by the Government County Court of Appeals by defending this case would be a logical, properly reasoned, and statutorily based manner in which to do this, as has been urged, and this is the way.
Thank you. Mr. Rosenberg saved about 30 seconds.
If we take the date of the contract like you want and apply Hill, you lose on setoff.
That would be true if Hill existed. Hill doesn't exist. It was wiped out. It's the statute.
It did at the time of the contract.
That's right, but it's the statute that remains constant. It's the statute that is incorporated into the contract, not case law. Case law is not incorporated. You look at the statute, and then by whenever you get around to the issue, you apply what your understanding is of how to interpret that statute at this point. We already know that there's only one way to interpret that statute. The statute hasn't changed. Only the positional law interpreting that statute changed. So no, it would still be in the case law interpretation of Colvin Savoy. Now, as far as, I'm out of time. just quickly, I brought up the point on cause of action about tortfeasor, don't you need a tortfeasor? Well, the action of the tortfeasor is not going to make, or the tortfeasor is insured, it's not going to make him any more or less underinsured. That's all determined at the time of the accident. He has as much insurance as he's ever going to have in that case. And you can look at the available policy limits as per the statute at that time.
Thank you, Tamara. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Counselor, excuse, we have an admission ceremony following this, so you can leave. Or you can remain if you'd like to, but you don't have to.